the course Imaging the Self is a course that I inherited when I came to PLU 2 years ago. I was on a sabbatical replacement, and one of the people who taught the course and designed the course, a man named Ernst Schwitter, was going away, and I sort of fell into it. And in some ways, I think it was one of the best falls I ever took. It started me on a whole wonderful apprenticeship, is sort of the way I look at it. The course was designed originally as a way of tying in autobiographical imagery and visual imagery in a way of sort of integrating them. It's in the integrated study program at Pacific Lutheran, which is a larger attempt at putting back together the pie that has been divided into slices for the last millennia or two. And I guess what it became for me was a tool for my own self-discovery. And I'm so excited by it, and I grow so much from it, and I have such positive relationships with the people that I share with it that it's almost become a kind of life for me. If it wasn't for this class, I doubt that I would probably still be at PLU right now. So that's what I'm doing here, essentially.
One of the fun things about this course is it gives me an excuse to reread the books that I read secretly before, outside of class. And when I joined this faculty 2 years ago, I was interested in branching out and working with other departments besides being a performer in music. You know, you almost never get out of a practice room if you're into a certain instrument. So one of my interests is working with other people, and one of the ways that I find very useful to renew myself and also handle a tremendous amount of stress while teaching is to teach with somebody else. So this is kind of like a holiday and a vacation because I don't have to turn up at the secondary ed meetings and work on the handbook revision, and I don't have to attend some of the other meetings, and I can come and share new information. And also I learn a lot from what the students have to share with me. I'm also a student, and I think it's a very exciting thing when people are concerned and take their own selves seriously and want to delve into it. It's kind of magical. How about some of the rest of you?
Yeah, what are you guys doing here?
I'm here actually not because I really need to be. I mean, in the sense that I don't need lit credit or art credit or a core two credit. And I just heard such good things about the class from roommates I had in the past and other people that, you know, I see these weird art projects they've been working on. And I go, what are they doing? And they say it's a lot of fun. They learn a lot about themselves. And then when I heard that it was coming to Holden Village, I just said, I gotta go. Because I've been here before, and I really like Holden a lot, also.
Anyone else want to share anything out there?
For me, it's the time I'm trying to make a lot of different kinds of decisions, and the more I think about it, the more confused I get, and the farther behind I get in trying to make the decisions. And I was getting really frustrating, and when I found out that I had the opportunity to come to a place where I might be able to figure out more just who I was and try and help make some decisions from that point. And when I found out that I could come to a place here like this where it's, I had heard so much about, you know, it's just what you want to be, and the people that are really willing to accept whatever, and it's really relaxing and really fun. Then I thought it would just be so much better than hanging around a PLU and having to deal with everybody going, you know, that sounds like a really stupid class and what a waste of time, and you know, and so you come up here and people want to come find out and get out of the class and stuff. And so it's just a good time to a good place in the class and a good way to figure out what I want to do more or less.
Questions out there in the field. the class is one of those things that sort of stimulates almost anything and everything. That the literature is designed. Kate and I pretty much, except for the Russell Baker book Growing Up, which is a straightforward autobiography, which I think is a very well-written, tightly constructed, wonderful book to read, and Black Elk, which is an autobiography, sort of a biography from a very different point of view, are the only things that are consistent with the way the course is taught on campus. All the rest of the books are Kate and Lori's choice for the class. That we really thought about it very carefully and decided to shift the class from essentially being autobiographical with developing a self-knowledge as a side effect. We decided to make it developing self-knowledge as the central issue and autobiography as a side issue. That makes it a lot more powerful, a lot more tricky, a little more confusing, and a whole lot more fun. One other thing I'd like to add about it is, as an artist, I find that the only way you can really do work that speaks well, both to yourself and to other people, is to be able to delve deeper and deeper and deeper with greater clarity into that pool of whatever your center might be. And a course like this, teaching it and taking it, help, I think, to clear the waters and develop the lung capacity to go farther and farther down. I would hope that that happens with the students, too. This is the only course I've ever taught in all the schools I've taught where my students keep coming back semester after semester after semester, wanting to know if it can be offered again, if there's going to be another course like it they can take. People who've graduated have come back just to sit in and look at the other art projects that have been there. So it definitely seems to have an effect on people. We also, if it wasn't so popular, I sort of wonder sometimes, since it suffers a great deal of criticism from other parts of the campus, because it is not the kind of information that you can, that leads to something else. It's not part of a skill training. It's not necessarily part of academic training.
And no final exams.
And no final exams.
That's kind of something that helped me draw me, to the class.
You mean get
attracted me?
Get attracted.
And that was that it wasn't a regular type of educational class where you sit there and you have the tests, and it's basically, I guess, I see the difference is that it's not as objective, I guess, or the way it teaches is not objective, and the issues are not totally objective issues, but more subjective, which is harder to deal with. But I think, for me anyway, I think it's more important to who I am and to life, just in general for me, is subjectivity. Because in school, I mean, I get tons of objectivity tests, you know, and writing and math and books, you know, and not only is this type of stuff more fun, but it's stuff that can stick with you throughout all of your life. Whereas if I was studying like engineering and I decided I didn't want to be an engineer, that is kind of like a waste of time.
Maybe even if you wanted to be an engineer, it might be a waste of time.
Well, what was it someone said about the kind of information you get being outdated within a certain number of years?
Yeah.
Well, I was kind of curious how I can make this apply to the people who aren't in the class, but we're talking about the imaging itself, and how do people who take this class image themselves? We must have something mutually similar, or something that I know a lot of people at school who would not take this class. I'm just curious, if we're talking about imaging itself, what's our image of ourselves because we take this as a different
standard?
That's a good point.
Another question is how is your image going to change because of the course, if at all?
I wonder if maybe for those of you who aren't familiar with the structure of the course, if I might sort of outline that a little bit, it might help just a bit. The course is structured like a lifetime, starting with birth and ending with death. What it tries to do is to, in a very compacted way, relive many of the basic and important issues that we go through throughout life. And it tries to do so from a multitude of points of view, both counterculture, intercultural, and from points of view of different generations and different eras. So the course starts out with birth, and it talks about birth as a symbol. Birth and death comes up briefly at the beginning as we talk about that. We go through the Russell Baker book, which is a very intimate autobiography of someone who grew up during and throughout the Depression. And we relate that to our individual lives. We try and find basic themes, see if those themes make any sense to us, compare and contrast to our own feelings. We work with a lot of free writing, where we, without trying to judge or interfere with any thought, just start writing our train of thought about an individual subject or image, like our childhood toys, a photograph of ourselves, as a way of getting into a more personal experience of our childhood. Then we move from there, sort of through a burgeoning adolescence, I guess is where the course might be, where we talk about Black Elk's biography. As a Sioux Indian, for those who aren't familiar with the book, he volunteered giving his spiritual information to a white man just about 10 or 15 years before he died. That was published in a book, Nihard, I guess is his name, and translated by him and his family into English. And it talks about Black Elk's life, how he experienced the closing days of the Indian nation, American Indian nation, and how he participated in the Messiah movement, which was a last-ditch effort in the 1890s of the Plains Indians to reaffirm and ideally recapture the lands that had been stolen from them. Black Elk is a very amazing kind of character, and he shares a lot of his generosity through the book and through the years between then and now.
What years?
He died in 1947. He was born, I think he was like 89 years old when he died. So, he was a medicine man at the time and experienced some amazingly powerful visions that are only in part published in the book. I recently found out that that's about two-thirds of his visions are there. The rest were edited out by Nihard because they were so amazingly involved. And as Black Elk himself says, most of his vision was not communicated in a language that could even be interpreted through the Indian vocal language, because no matter how rich an imagery that is, let alone translated into English, so there's still some that has not been made available to us. But his imagery still speaks to us, even through all the filters of translation, all the filters of time, and of two cultures that have never been able to coexist. It still manages to speak very powerfully.
And the tie-in of this book with the rest of the course.
Go ahead.
Is through his imaging, through his visions, and his search within himself. And it's perhaps a little distant for some of us to read, but it still has a lot of bearing on how one gains one's reality in this world.
And what one's reality is. The amazing thing about the Indian nation, the Native American nations, is that their reality was more focused on dreams and personal and passionate expressions of that, unlike the rational Western mind. And it talks about how that reality worked until it came head to head with technology. And that's an amazingly poignant kind of story that's repeated throughout. From there, in talking about dreams and our inner life, we sort of delve even deeper into dreams into a fictional account called the Kinivada, which is talking about a place where there is no other reality other than dreams. Why don't you talk about that one, Kate, since you're presenting it?
Well, it's the counterbook to the Myths of Avalon. We decided not to use that because the course is so short and the book is so long. But it's tying in with the previous two books in that the main character has to come to terms with himself, and everything he believes is counter to what someone like Black Elk believes. So he has to go through this incredible inner struggle inside himself, come to terms with what he has been, what he has done, what his culture is, and what he can do about all of his behavior in the past. He talks about all the dis-eases that people experience. And it's a very quick reading book. It has a lot of visual imagery in it, and it reads more like a movie. Black Elk, I think, is a lot more difficult because it's, although it's very personal as well, it is so involved. So I think The Kin is a very immediate book, and the fact that everybody is not necessarily an individual, but together, collectively, they can do an incredible amount of good in this world. And the fact that in the other world, that is the world we live in, there are these kin around who have been sent in to redeem or transform the world that's sort of teetering on this brink. It's a very intriguing message for us at this point in our history. A lot of science fiction, a lot of, I guess you'd call it sort of more feminist writing in this book than the others I found.
Another thing that's real powerful about both Black Elk and Kin is that they talk about community. And as you mentioned, that idea of community is not only as a force for good and a force of self-realization, but as an important way of finding yourself through a commitment to that idea of community. And The Kin, the community that exists in a dream world that this man is transformed and becomes a part of, that is all there is, that there is no other context. And in some ways it supports what Black Elk experiences in the language of the West.
If you know. What does the term kin mean in that book?
It's like family, tribe. The next book we go into, which is a sort of a biography, a fictional biography, Narcissus and Golden, which many of you may be familiar with, a book by Hermann Hesse, the I think he was Swiss, wasn't he? Mystic writer of the 20s and 30s. It's a book that starts in a monastery where two men befriend themselves. The one is a young teacher, the other is a student, and both feel their Christianity very strongly. One chooses to stay in the monastery to ultimately become the abbot. The other one chooses to pursue a more feminine element, becomes a wanderer, a lecherer, an artist, just about everything you can imagine. Yes. And eventually comes back to the monastery, and they meet again. It's basically talking about two very separate ways of experiencing spirituality. And the thing that Hess does so wonderfully is that he weaves spirituality and sensuality and sexuality in such a positive and an open kind of way that it's really hard to close your heart to it, even though it's a translation, and I think it loses something by not being read in the original German. I still think that it's a real powerful kind of book.
It's also nice to have a book about two guys, both of whom are good guys. They're totally opposite, and they're both wonderful in their own way.
And they both love each other very, very much, which is another thing that's real powerful about it. It deals with love between men in a way that that a lot of literature doesn't do well.
It's written as a story.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's written as a narrative story, but very, very powerful.
The other book that's in the bookstores is
Siddhartha.
Is the other, the sort of sister to that book. And it's shorter?
Yeah, it's much shorter. Yeah.
You can read it in one night. But
that's a spiritual journey.
It's a very spiritual journey.
Sort of East meets West. That when I was growing up in the 60s, that was a sort of transformational piece of literature mm-hmm. that opened a lot of our minds. And it's very simple, and I think it's still pretty strong. And in fact, I've read everything that's in English translation, and I'm never disappointed with that, with anything that he's written. Anyway,
John Gardner.
Right, then we move on to one of my favorite books of all time, Grendel by John Gardner, one of my favorite authors of all time. And basically what he does is he takes the Beowulf legend and tells it from the monster's point of view. And it's a, it's humorous, it's pathetic,
scary.
It's sad, it's scary. And what it does is, since most of us having had or experienced the legend of Beowulf in English 101 or something like that, it tells a very different point of view of the exact same event, which helps us kind of understand that the world isn't as simple a place as we thought it was.
And the villains are human too.
That's right, and the villains struggle with their identity. And and have to constantly experience in order to be able to find it.
And deal with their mothers.
And deal with their mothers, right. The father isn't there. I often wondered about that. And let's see, then we...
Excuse me, Laurie, that's also a very Scandinavian book.
Right.
Let's bring that in.
Thank you. I would have missed that. And then after that, we go into Illusions, which some of you may be familiar with. It's a book that was here in the bookstore. Richard Bach, which is a different kind of view of what a Messiah is and what personal and inner divinity is all about. Very quick reading, very, very poetic. It's gushy in a real positive way, as most of his books are. And I think that book is a real good book to kind of, I think that's the last book we read. So I think it's a real good book to kind of close it all off. It's a book that kind of encapsulates much of it in a real easy reading way. And one other book that many of the folks here are getting, which is the book I wanted to use, is the book on the taboo against knowing who you are by
Alan Watts.
Thank you. It slipped my mind for a moment. Alan Watts is another one of those people who sort of thrust the 60s upon us in real powerful ways. And that's a book that, although very very chatty and overly intellectual, language is overly intellectual, he does talk about how difficult it is to figure out who you are when the culture is structured in every way, shape, and form to stop you from doing it. And it's he does a pretty good job using the language that that we have that is entrapping. So he first destroys the language, and then he reforms it for you in a different kind of way. It's a book I've read now 4 times, and the last time I read it in preparation for the class, it still told me all kinds of wonderful things.
The Bearer That Wasn't is the very shortest book that has the most pictures in it. And I've given it to more children than adults, but the adults who read to their children love it. And I've seen people blow up pictures out of each page and color them. The steam shovel picture seems to be the favorite. the bear wakes up after hibernation and discovers himself in the factory. And the foreman comes and tells him to get to work. So, of course, he doesn't know exactly what's going on, and he questions the foreman's orders. And he gets brought to various and sundry people, the assistant to the vice president and the vice president. And finally, he makes it all the way to the president through all these offices with secretaries and all kinds of decorations, edging on the wall. And each office has more secretaries. So it's quite... 1946, quite sexist book because all the secretaries are blondes, women sitting on their rumps in little secretary chairs, and all of the administration is male, but don't let that bother you. The bear is still wonderful. The president says, well, obviously, you're a man who needs a shave and wears a fur coat. So they put him to work, and he works all year, and then the office, the big factory closes down, and all the people leave. And the bear isn't sure who he is. So he sets out on a search to discover what to do with himself, because of course his job is gone and he's been laid off. And the factory's locked up and he can't stay there because there's this big iron fence around with a board across. So he goes around and travels, and finally they take him to a circus where he sees other bears, and these bears are dressed up in these cute little clown suits, and they're riding around on their tricycles. And they ask these bears in the circus if this guy by them is a bear, and they all laugh and fall off their tricycles and say, oh no, he's not a bear. If he were a bear, he would be in here wearing this funny clown suit and riding on a tricycle, so he can't be a bear. So then they take him to the zoo, and a similar thing happens. Well, after getting all these messages from all these other people of what he is not, it starts to snow and it starts to get cold. And he sits down in the snow, and there are icicles dripping off his nose. And he just sort of wonders what to do. And the ending of the book, I'll leave up to you, but it's a real nice imaging the self kind of ending. So, the illustrations are quite charming, and I encourage you to go go and trot into the bookstore and look for the hot pink cover. Yeah, there wasn't. The whole form of the book is quite much like nature, because the first page is the bear looked up at the sky and the leaves are falling down and the geese were flying south. And the ending of the book is similar. So by the end of the book, you really love the bear. You really are convinced that the bear is one of your favorite characters. And whenever anyone counters what you're doing and says, well, who do you think you are? Your answer is already preformed in your mind. You're a silly man who needs a shave and wears a fur coat. It's very clear. That's what you are. And if anyone questions you and you read that book, then you know what to do at the end.
One last thing to flesh out this whole story is I'm the artist and I didn't mention anything about the art part of this class. One of the things that most people know least about is visual imagery. I think it's kind of amazing in a culture that manipulates so effectively through the use of visual language that we very rarely educate ourselves and our children about what visual language is and its power. So one of the things I try to do, I had to eliminate two of the art projects because of being here and having limited facilities and materials, but most people kind of scrounge their materials as they need them, and we obviously are somewhat limited that way. Basically what I try and do is through experiencing art, and now we're sort of substituting a lot of music, which is a very powerful art form, we try to develop a small amount of visual literacy. Everyone writes. Most people have become reasonably literate, especially at PLU. They spell well enough to have other people understand what words they're using. They know how to formulate sentences fairly well. They even some of them know how to type. It's truly an amazing experience. But most people drop the crayons in second grade, and their experience of the visual imagery is basically watching television and looking at advertising. And advertising is, of course, the there is a devil in the world, frankly. I think it's advertising, but that's another story. So what I try and do is to, through a dizzying historical perspective on some schools of art, without having to focus in on time frames and individual artists' names, I try to help people develop, first, the confidence that they can interpret visual imagery themselves, no matter who they are and what their how knowledgeable they are, and two, that through constantly experiencing it and thinking about it and emoting it and feeling about it, they can slowly be able to develop a skill that that not only can express themselves, but a skill through which they can make more intelligent decisions about their entire world. Since I think much information is subliminally communicated through very important means. So the projects they do are first a shrine to their childhood, which is a complex kind of thing that maybe I'll have them describe. And the other project they do is a choice of either doing a full-size, life-size portrait of their inner self or their outer self. The class in the PLU does the inner self, and then they have to do a costume that expresses their outer self, which has been one of the things that creates the most attention, I think, on campus, seeing these people wandering around dressed as aspirin bottles and trees and various and sundry other weird things. And one last thing I'll say about it. My problem is that I always say one last thing and then think of something else to talk about. Weaving through it all are a series of issues that we constantly raise. Some of them are written here, which I'll read off to you. Others are not, which I'll probably won't remember. But I mentioned birth and death. Also, the idea of competence. Creation, destruction, ideas about dreams and meditation, I've already talked about, surrealism, form versus substance, inner and outer realities. Let's see, what else do we have written down here? We talk about our external lives as a metaphor. I do a presentation on costume and the car and the evolution of those as how they reflect our own image of ourselves and how powerful they are as sort of keeping things going in a particular direction. What else? Then we also get back to death again in a different sort of way, not in the context of death as opposed to birth, but as a context of acceptance and awareness. Also, there's a whole lot of other stuff that sort of comes up in and out and around through it all. It all relates to the literature, and it all kind of forms this huge, monstrous, wormy package that, slimy as it may be, would ideally plant a few seeds. And the journal is actually the most important part of the whole class. That's how, and we have to come up with a grade. That's the whole idea. And the journal is how the students are graded. Basically, they're graded on their commitment. And the journal is the place where they talk about their commitment. They have six basic sections. I'll see if I can remember them without referring to my notes. One of them is just taking notes in class, which is a formal thing about class presentations where we talk about form and structure of the literature, bring up other issues, and encourage conversation and discussion about some of them are just kind of formal note-taking. Another one is a personal response to what happens in class. They may be talking about a particular issue that creates certain feelings or memories or something else that comes around, and so they have a chance to respond in the journal if they don't get a chance to do so, or in addition to doing so verbally. Another section is a response to the reading, note-taking in response to the reading itself. So they get a chance to sort of take notes and figure out a little bit, jotting down some important little events and topics that occur to them as they're reading. It's another way for us to make sure that they've actually read the book. Then they have to more personally comment on the reading as well. Oftentimes, like in Russell Baker, for instance, it talks about childhood. Many people start experiencing their own childhood through it, even though the childhood itself that Russell Baker talks about is not directly related. It starts stirring up those wonderfully muddy waters. And let's see, there's another one there.
In class writing,
right. That's where we do the free writes, where we give them a chance to write without judgment, ideally. And I find that it's a real powerful tool for saying things you normally wouldn't have allowed yourself to say. Free writing is a real valuable thing. For those of you who haven't experienced it, it's a wonderful, wonderful tool. I often find that even when I am too tired, that I think that I can never do any writing, I make myself do free writing, and I start off talking about how stupid it is to do free writing because I'm so tired I can't even possibly push the pen around. And before I know it, something really significant kind of just pops out of nowhere. They're really, really neat. So the only thing I don't like about the free writing is usually everyone's penmanship is really horrible. And then the last section is a dream journal, or at least right now we're just sort of documenting dreams as we have them. We'll talk about what they may or may not mean, although I don't like to get into dream analysis too heavily. And just any kind of additional thing you may want to say. Notes on a conversation you had, response, memories or ideas that pop up, whatever it may or may not be. And basically, we don't grade on the style of writing. We try not to grade on penmanship, but if you can't read it, I guess, what are you going to do? But we basically, like I say, want to see the commitment. And that commitment is a very personal one. So whatever your personal beliefs are, there's always room for them, as long as we look at them, analyze them, feel about them, and really do our best to be as honest and as my mind's going blank. As honest as possible. I think I'm done with that part of my conversation. Do you have anything to say about that? I'd like to know how you guys feel. I mean, now the faculty has shared their feelings about it. You guys have experienced it now for almost a week. Maybe you'd like to share something about it.
Well, I'm one of those useless engineering majors. Are learning things that are going to be obsolete and unnecessary. I find this course both really a relief and also a great cause of anxiety at the same time. It's so much different than physics, calculus, and electric circuits that I've had. And right now I'm not really sure how to handle it. It's hard switching from an analytical type class to free form.
Touch and feel leader.
It's like going from portraits you know, photographic portraits to free form, you know, pop art or something. And it's kind of a jumble right now. But I'm excited about it because, you know, it does give me a chance to ask questions, you know, why am I going into engineering? It's just, and is that something that is worthwhile? And it helps, you know, as a starting point to asking hard questions that they don't teach you in the engineering department.
My experience within the class is kind of, I'm finding when we're talking about in the class, it seems that some of the instances or some of what we talk in class I've kind of gone through before in the process of going up, and this class is really helping to get the academic or more, a little bit more directed in how we look and how we act and why we act, what we do. And it also, it's opening us up to a different perspective, a very different perspective from going to our conscious, directed, analytical, engineering mind to a little bit more. With my brother over Christmas gave me such a hard time, kind of a touchy-feely kind of look, or something more relying on the thoughts that come immediately to mind, or unconscious, that kind of unconscious ideas that seem to pop up, and we kind of wonder about why they are there and how they affect our conscious acts.
Talked about in this class focusing more on self-knowledge than you have in the past with the, what, obviously you've explained some of the strategies for that, the journal and the projects. What are some of the other ways that you're trying to encourage self-knowledge through your class?
Well, I guess that self-awareness, I suppose, is the word I guess I would prefer to use, although I might have said self-knowledge, in the sense that if we become real aware of who we are, then I think we can make more intelligent and personal decisions about what we do with that thing that we are. So the best way I know of finding out who we are is to observe ourselves, and to try and observe ourselves with as few of our imagined, stereotypical, handed down cliches as possible. So one of the other strategies would be to point out in as intimate and as gentle a way as possible how self-defeating some of those cliches can be. And the only way I know of being able to separate cliches from your own inner self is to give you a lot of information that keeps your rational mind so busy it doesn't know what else to do, and then create exercises so that your intuitive, emotional, feeling, non-rational part has a chance to express itself. And then, through a reflective process, be able to look at what it says and what it was about. It's not an easy process, and it certainly isn't one that we can finish in 3.5 weeks. But I think it's one that can bear fruit fairly quickly, at least surprising results, if not exactly fruit. And it's that sort of a process. It's sort of like, it's like how you create an art form. Part of it has to do with developing skill and being able to utilize that kind of tool of whatever it is. That's the kind of rational mind. Our culture does that very, very well. But the biggest and best tool-making culture that ever existed, sort of completely inundated almost every other culture on the planet, and it's having a lot of trouble as a result of that. But the other part is equally important. You can't make a piece of art if you just have skill. All you do is have a real nice facsimile, something that is doesn't speak from the soul, doesn't address or communicate any kind of transcendent. It is not synergistic in the sense that it's bigger than the sum of its parts. You need also to have that part that is automatic, that part that comes from some other inner pool. You can call it God, you can call it divinity, you can call it intuition, you can call it whatever you want. But there needs to be a balance. And that's what happens in the class, is to use them both. And use them both in a way that they can work together as opposed to battling each other, which is mostly what happens.
Chris, were you interested in the rest of the projects?
I think part of what's happening with a lot of us that I've noticed is that we talk a lot about, you know, I mean, you'll just kind of start talking about your family or about high school for you or about just a lot of different things. And it's nice because it's okay just to be talking about that and to say, you know, God, I mean, your mom's really like that, or, you know, or just a lot of different things. And when you talk about it, a lot of things come up, because when you're just talking, things just sort of flow out. And for me, they flow out faster than I can write, so I talk.
That's what that noise has been that I've been.
Yeah. and it's just by talking to someone else, you find out a lot more about that, and then it gives you a lot of different ideas to write about and to to explore more just by yourself.
Well, we asked them to do it more than one way. So, do you want to describe?
Yeah, we did two kinds of free writing about it. First, I gave them a little time to kind of meditate and sort of get into that face. Most of us experience our childhood not through our own eyes, but through the eyes of our parents. I mean, who took those pictures of us as kids but our relatives? You know? And most of our early childhood memories are re-visualizations of stories they've told us anyhow. So what I try and do is to get them to open up enough to maybe let something else sneak out. It's a process that usually can't take place in one or two free writes, but it's certainly something that could start. So I take it from two points of view. One, staring at that baby picture, looking at themselves, and trying to get back into who they were and remembering who that person was who has that baby face. It's not an easy thing to do, and I think a lot of kids, since it was their first free write anyway, probably struggled with it. And then we do another one, where I ask them, what did their parents think of that? That child, what were the attitudes about it? And ideally what happens is that we find something out by comparing and contrasting both of those free writes. It's the kind of discovery that, like I say, can't happen in 2 5-minute free writes. But I think what I like about that whole idea is that the first time I ever did something like that, I started realizing that my values were my parents' values. They weren't my personal values. And I think I wish I'd have known that a lot earlier. And some folks have already talked about that a little bit. And Betty certainly talked about that today when she came in and talked to the class, which I thought was a real powerful kind of thing too. Did that answer the question? From our point of view, I'd like to know.
Gloria's still interested in asking
what the kids discovered a little bit. Yeah. Kids.
If you didn't discover anything, you can own that up too, you know. Just to remember your grades on the line.
Yeah, I was put up to this.
But actually, some of them have already turned their journals in already, so it's too late, so they might as well.
Yeah.
Wrong. One of my pictures was of my dad and I, and my dad died when I was like 2, and so I never thought of him as a big part of my life. I never really thought about him, and that was it. But I found this picture, and he's working on his bike, and I'm working on my bike, and I'm like 1.5 years old, and I'm standing there, I've got my screwdriver, and you know, and dad's just smiling, and yeah, and she's cute, and it's just kind of, I don't know, I see how early I was how early they started teaching me to do things on my own and later through stories that my mom told me, she sort of regretted that she had set me up to be such an independent child. But I mean, I saw that it wasn't just my mom. If I had to make a pie out of it, she would be the major part of it, but there's still that part of me that comes from my dad, and that, you know, and I had never thought about, you know, what his effect on me was and how I was brought into the world with both parents, and that was real important. And I had never thought about that before. And then later, I have a picture of just my mom and my two brothers and I, and it's this little pyramid that we always did. And it just, when I looked at it then, it became more of a symbol in that it was, you know, we were balanced, and the whole family together made this little unit, and if one person fell off, then the whole thing was out of whack, and it didn't work anymore, and that we kind of hung together like that, and we're all kind of spread out, and it's not like we're, you know, clinging, but you always know that other support was there, and I guess I'd known that, but I had never really realized how much it was a part of me from the very, since I was 3 years old.
Any of the rest of you reluctant guys want to share?
Well, I thought it was kind of funny. My first line, I said that was very short back then. I don't know why that came out. Just looking back, it was very short. And one of the feelings I remember from doing that was a feeling of not taken as seriously as I wanted to be. Feeling like I had some that I thought I had some important input on the adult talk. What I said was intelligent. You know, I had some things that were worth saying, and that I wasn't taken seriously. I also remember the pictures of Mia with the jacket, I remember, or at least having the jacket put on, the hood and the strap being tied, you know, underneath my chin, and I always hated that, so it was cut in my chin. But that one point, the main thing I got out of that.
It works sometimes, and it doesn't work.
Well, that ticked me off too when they did it.
And you don't have Theo's beard, though, so that doesn't.
From looking at my childhood, well, mine's still sitting on the drawer back home where I think I get ready to a visual image of the picture of my mind. You know, I was a cute kid with a nice smile and cute dimples and nice brown hair. And looking at that, or previously looking at the picture I looked at, and thought, what a cute kid. And that was about it, you know, nice dimples. Whatever happened, oh well, I've still got the brains.
Of a 2-year-old?
But no previous thoughts have really come about of looking at this picture. And then from doing the reading of the Russell Baker book, and then also doing the pre-writes of just sitting there and thinking of my picture of myself and what my parents thought, it sinks in. There's a lot more to childhood than just being a cute kid. The friends that I wrote about, the friends that I was with, and how I think they affected me in some way, and how I grew up a little bit in association with them. And my parents directing me and they're wanting me to be a cute kid. And just, I don't know, I think as we're now young adults supposedly, most of us don't look back upon our childhood and seriously think about it like we delve into it like we have in this class. We just think of ourselves as cute kids and we don't quite realize what a tremendous impact you all parents have upon us and outside influences.
Yeah, I thought, looking at my picture, I thought about washing my face and cleaning my face, and remember I hated it. I mean, she'd take the warm washcloth and she'd be scrubbing all over my face, and she'd scrub so hard, like, I couldn't imagine it could be that dirty. But, I mean, that was bad enough, but there was something even worse than that. Is when we were away, when we weren't at home and there weren't any washcloths, she'd dig into her purse and grab out a Kleenex, and the Kleenex always had lipstick on it. And I remember that, you know, she'd spit on the Kleenex and start scrubbing my face with the Kleenex that had spit on it and lipstick, and I expect that to get me clean, and I just was so absurd.
is this your beard growth kind of a protectant?
That's another reason I'm growing.
Mom will probably try and wipe it off with Kleenex.
Yeah. I think one of the other fun things was someone mentioning to me, was it you, Chris, that you sent a 6-page letter home?
Mm-hmm.
She talks, remember, she doesn't remember.
Maybe the table. I need to call it.
Somebody at lunch or someplace had indicated that they had done that for the first time that they could ever think of. I don't know who it was.
I think it was it Carrie, maybe?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, it might be Carrie.
Whose absence I'm noting down. But.
Well, she doesn't have a sticker. She doesn't get a sticker.
One thing I'd like to, there are several community members who sat in or overheard our session today, and I just sort of like to know what your response was to all that. Sort of thinking about how heavy this conversation is, has become all serious and all, but. You have a lot of fun.
She's the one who keeps them.
I have a question about the music that you were listening to the other couple days. What is the imaging of self that how does the music lend to that? That idea of learning more about yourself.
You mean the music of the 30s and 40s or the pre-writes or the
music of the 30s and 40s that you were using?
Let's see. What was the first one? Do you remember? Why don't you do right? Russell Baker's mother message tied in with that song because the lyrics are, you made plenty of money in 1922, you let other women make a fool of you, why don't you do right like some other men do, get out of here and get me some money too. The message that the woman is essentially depending upon the man to bring home the bacon totally, and the woman's role is to prod. And sometimes when you read a book, it sinks into a certain level. Other times when you listen to the music, it sinks in to a deeper level. The message of the book and the song were identical in a lot of ways. The song was from exactly the same period. The kind of music that Russell Baker would have been listening to had he had a phonograph would have been exactly that same thing. So one of the purposes of the music is to get the students focused in again when they first meet on a certain image or on a certain idea or a thought that we discussed in the past or on a certain theme. And it seems to me that a lot of the music that I played that was geared toward giving them a background of the feel for the Depression, a background of the myths that the people had at that time, the desire to have a place of their own with refrigerators, sofa, etc. The other themes of the book, the woman's role, man's role, messages, and we also got into some of the views of war, and I played some of the music that was from Russell Baker's Clasp. That is, I didn't play the black blues song, but I played sort of the white blues songs. I didn't play the heavy duty music, but I played more the Russell Baker type of music, and it addressed major issues such as attitudes towards Roosevelt, attitudes towards poor people, attitudes towards the Depression, or attitudes